Support for NPR podcasts comes from HBO, presenting the new dramatic series In Treatment, Monday through Friday at 9:30 p.m.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the new book, God in the White House, Randall Bomer examines how faith has shaped the presidency. From John F. Kennedy, who argued that being Catholic was irrelevant to his qualifications as president, to George W. Bush, who said that Jesus is his favorite philosopher. Bomer says the narrative tells the story not only of the politicization of religion, but also the religionization of politics. Bomer describes himself as an evangelical Christian whose understanding of the teachings of Jesus points him toward the left of the political spectrum. He's a professor of religious history at Barnard College, Columbia University, and a visiting professor at Yale University Divinity School and Dartmouth College. He's editor-at-large for Christianity Today. His book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture, was adapted into a PBS documentary series. Randall Bomer, welcome back to Fresh Air.
My pleasure, Terry. Good to be with you again.
Now, your book starts with JFK, the first Catholic president. During his campaign, he argued that religion wasn't a legitimate criterion for choosing a president. Was faith typically discussed by presidential candidates then?
It wasn't all that common for presidential candidates to really talk about their faith in kind of personal, confessional terms. And I think the reason for that is simply that most Americans assumed that a candidate would have some sort of faith, and most Americans assumed that it would be a kind of generic Protestant faith. When Eisenhower ran in 1952, for example, it came out in the course of the campaign that he had never been baptized as a Christian, and his response was, well, as soon as the campaign is over, I'll get around to it. Can you imagine a candidate today saying something like that?
So how did Kennedy try to neutralize the religion issue during his campaign?
Kennedy, as he was gearing up for the 1960 campaign, recognized that the religious issue, as it was known then, would be an issue in the campaign, and there were several reasons for that. Of course, you have the historical precedent of the 1928 presidential campaign when Alfred E. Smith, the Democratic governor of New York and a Roman Catholic, was the Democratic nominee, and he lost to Herbert Hoover largely because of religious issues in that campaign. And the other precedent that Kennedy had to deal with was the publication and the popularity of a book by Paul Blanchard called American Freedom and Catholic Power, published in 1949 by Beacon Press in Boston, which was quite popular. It went through several editions, 11 printings in as many months. And what was remarkable about that book was not that this was an anti-Catholic screed, which in many ways it was, arguing that the Roman Catholic Church and Roman Catholicism generally was antithetical to American democratic institutions, but the fact that it had been written by someone who was not a wacko from somewhere, but someone who had advanced degrees from places like the University of Michigan and Columbia University. So it was a respectable, or at least seen as a respectable, issue to bring up in 1949, and this book was enormously popular.
What were some of the other things that were set against him because he was Catholic? What were some of the arguments being made then about the dangers of having a Catholic president?
The principal argument was simply that a Roman Catholic, because he owes his obedience finally to the Pope, to the Vatican, would be influenced or might be influenced in his policies by the Vatican. And so Kennedy had to lay that to rest. And he did so finally with this remarkable speech he gave at the Rice Hotel in Houston on September 12, 1960, in which he argued, in effect, that voters should bracket out a candidate's faith when they went into the voting booth.
You reprint some of the anti-Catholic tracts that were published during Kennedy's campaign. Let me read a couple of excerpts of things that were published. That a Roman Catholic president in the White House is the next step planned by the hierarchy of enthroned cardinals, bishops, and priests. Help us defeat the Roman political machine from making America Catholic. Don't let any Catholic convince you that his oath to his state or government comes first. A Catholic is bound to his church from infancy. How much traction did these things have?
I think it had quite a bit. anecdotal evidence that I uncovered at the JFK Library and other places indicated that these tracts, these broadsides, were circulating fairly widely within the countryside. And just before the voting in many Protestant churches is so-called Reformation Sunday, which, of course, commemorates Martin Luther's nailing of the 95 Theses to the cathedral door at Wittenberg on October 31st, 1517. And this was the occasion for a kind of last-minute, last-gasp appeal by many Protestant ministers arguing that their people should not vote for a Roman Catholic for president.
On the other side, there were religious groups that said religion shouldn't be an issue when it comes to electoral politics. There was a group called the Fair Campaign Practices Committee, which included rabbis, Catholics, Protestant leaders. George Romney was one of the members, the father of Mitt Romney, who went on himself to become governor of Michigan in 62. They prepared a special statement on religion in the 1960 campaign. Can you give us a sense of what it said?
It said, in effect, that we should disregard or at least discount a candidate's religious preferences or his religious affiliations as we consider who we're going to vote for president. And they were trying to, in effect, guarantee the rights of minority religious groups that they would have equal access to elective office, including the presidency.
And how effective was their statement?
I think that was part of a growing reaction in the 1960 campaign to all of this anti-Catholic rhetoric and all of this anti-Kennedy rhetoric. So I think it was part of a reaction. And in fact, when the Protestant ministers gather at the Mayflower Hotel just after Labor Day in the 1960 campaign and issue a press conference or conduct a press conference afterwards, trying to call attention to the Catholic issue, I think that the reaction was fairly significant on the part of the public, saying, how dare you raise these issues? And in fact, one of the reporters asked Norman Vincent Peale, well, did you guys discuss Nixon's Quakerism and how that might affect his conduct as president? And Peale responded with an utterly unintentionally funny remark that turned out, in fact, to be quite prophetic. He said, in effect, that Nixon never let his faith bother him in any way.
Well, tell us more about this group that became known as the Peale Group that gathered at the Mayflower Hotel.
The Peale Group really has its origins in the previous month, in August of 1960, and even before that. Billy Graham, who of course was Nixon's friend and longtime confidant, had sent a letter to John F. Kennedy, which I came across in the JFK Library, early in August of that year, in which he it was a very friendly letter. He said that there had been rumors that he, Billy Graham, had intended to introduce the so-called religious issue in the fall campaign, and Graham assured Senator Kennedy that he had no intention of doing so. He allowed that he would probably vote for Richard Nixon, his friend, during that fall election, but he was not going to raise the religious issue. About 10 days later, however, Graham convenes a meeting of Protestant ministers in Montreux, Switzerland, including Norman Vincent Peale, who at that time was pastor of the Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, for the purpose of finding ways to deny Kennedy election to the presidency in November. Coming out of that meeting in Switzerland, then, there's a group of Protestant ministers, and Graham was not at that meeting, but a group of Protestant ministers who meet at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, trying to call attention to Kennedy's faith and how that might affect his conduct as president.
It sounds like Billy Graham was being a little disingenuous. On the one hand, he's saying to Kennedy, well, you know, I have to vote for Nixon because he's my old friend, but if you get elected, I'll help rally everybody to supporting you. But at the same time, he's helping to organize this, like, anti-Kennedy, anti-Catholic group.
I think it's probably fair to say that Billy Graham was being disingenuous with Kennedy, and I don't want to be too hard on him because he's an honorable man. And I think in this case, however, there's clear evidence that Graham, if not reneged, he at least waffled on his pledge to John Kennedy.
And so what did this group do? Like, what action did they actually take?
They didn't take much concrete action, as nearly as I can tell. But the press conference that came out of this meeting, there was 150 ministers gathered at the Mayflower Hotel, so it was a fairly large group. The press conference sought to call attention to that. And there was such a reaction on the part of, first of all, the reporters, but I think Americans generally, to the kind of brazen politicization that this group was engaged in, that I think ultimately it worked to their disadvantage. And Kennedy probably in the end benefited from it. And in fact, the meeting at the Mayflower Hotel was, as nearly as I can tell, the immediate catalyst for Kennedy deciding to go before the Houston Ministerial Association and give his famous address on why a Catholic can be president of the United States.
You know, it's funny, when Kerry was campaigning for president against George W. Bush, there were bishops that wanted to deny Kerry communion because of his pro-choice position. Do you think that those bishops' actions seem to justify or, you know, play into the concerns about a Catholic president being pressured to follow the church?
I think they do. And I think what I regretted on Kerry's behalf in 2004 is that Kerry tried to protest against this sort of thing. And I think the proper counter-argument would have been, well, if you're addressing the bishops, if you're going to deny communion to me because of my pro-choice stand, then it seems to me you also have to deny communion to other politicians, many of them Republicans, who defy Vatican teachings on, say, capital punishment or the morality of the invasion of Iraq. That would have been a fair and, I think, fairly effective rebuttal to the threats by the Catholic bishops.
Well, getting back to Kennedy, do you think that being Catholic actually affected any of his decisions in the White House?
I don't think it did. I think there's fairly clear evidence that Kennedy made good on his promise to govern as president without trying in any way to inflect his religious views into his policies as president. So I think he was very effective and faithful to his pledge.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Randall Balmer, and his new book is called God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. Now, you write that after Kennedy tried to remove religion as an issue in the campaign, Nixon kind of brought religion back into the White House. In what way did he bring faith into presidential politics?
I think that Kennedy's speech was so effective in 1960 that what I call the Kennedy paradigm of voter indifference toward a candidate's faith really prevailed, not only in 1960, at least sufficiently so that Kennedy could be elected in 1960, in 64, 68, again in 1972. And one index I would cite for that is that when Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, then the governor of Michigan, ran for the Republican presidential nomination in 1968, no one mentioned his faith. His Mormon faith was not an issue. I think that, ironically, Richard Nixon reintroduces faith to presidential politics in, obviously, a negative and kind of a backhanded way. I think it's impossible to imagine the presidency or even the candidacy of Jimmy Carter, a one-term governor of Georgia, had it not been for Richard Nixon. Americans were tired of the culture of corruption that had surrounded the Nixon administration. They were tired of Nixon's endless prevarications. And here you have an outsider to Washington, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher coming out of nowhere, not a Washington insider, promising never knowingly to lie to the American people, wanting a government as good and decent as the American people. And the voters ate it up.
So you're saying Nixon brought faith back into presidential politics by being morally corrupt, that people wanted to vote for somebody who they felt had a moral sense from their religion. But on the other hand, you say Nixon instituted worship services in the White House. He brought Billy Graham to the White House to conduct services. Billy Graham offered a prayer at Nixon's inauguration in which he thanked God that thou hast permitted Richard Nixon to lead us at this momentous hour of history. And he instituted worship services in the White House. Can you talk about the impact of that?
I think it's hard to escape the impression that those measures that Nixon took with the White House worship services in particular were anything but political theater. And in fact, Chuck Colson has a memorandum that I quote in the book where he says that he had been instructed by either Nixon himself or Haldeman, I forget now who had done this, to invite wealthier Republican donors as a kind of inducement for them to provide further support, financial and otherwise, to Nixon, especially as he approached re-election in 1972. I think it would be very hard, and I certainly haven't run across any historian prepared to argue that Nixon was a deeply pious and devout man whose piety, whose understanding of the faith really was reflected in his policies as president.
Jimmy Carter was the first self-identified evangelical president. When you reread or listen back to things that he said when he was campaigning for the White House, what do you hear that you think you wouldn't have quite got then? Things that may sound different to us now that religion has so permeated presidential politics?
I like to joke at times that when Jimmy Carter declared on the eve of the South Carolina primary in 1976 that he was a born-again Christian, he sent every journalist in New York scurrying to his Rolodex trying to figure out what in the world he meant by that. And in fact, the national press, the media, were utterly unprepared for a comment like that and didn't know what to make of it. Now that sort of language, of course, has become commonplace in American presidential politics. People talk about conversion experiences. People talk about being born again. But at the time, at least for the national media, that was something novel. I think the important dimension of the Carter campaign in 1976 was that he was able to lure many evangelicals out of their apolitical torpor. Ever since the Scopes trial of 1925, evangelicals had been politically quiescent for a number of reasons. One of them was simply that they felt that the larger culture was corrupt and not worth paying attention to, and certainly politics was corrupt. Jimmy Carter, using this language of being a born-again Christian, and I remember this very clearly myself as having grown up as an evangelical, we paid attention. This was new. This was exciting that one of our own was actually mounting a credible campaign for the presidency. And Carter is able to lure enough evangelical voters back into the political arena, Southerners especially, but others as well, that it really made a difference, I think, in the 1976 presidential campaign.
But then many of those evangelical voters became disillusioned with Carter.
I think that is the great irony of presidential politics over the last century, is what happened then. Very quickly, prodded by politically conservative activists, evangelicals turn against Jimmy Carter. And what I try to expose in the book, and I think I document copiously, is that the religious right did not coalesce as a political movement in direct response to the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. Catholics were already on board on the anti-abortion movement well before Roe v. Wade. But it was not an issue for evangelicals. In fact, the Southern Baptist Convention, which is hardly a bastion of liberalism, had passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion. And this was a resolution that was reaffirmed in 1974, again in 1976. It was not the abortion issue. What galvanized evangelicals as a political bloc, as a political movement, was instead the actions of the Internal Revenue Service to go after the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because of its racially discriminatory policies. And Carter was unfairly blamed for this by the architects of the religious right, and they used that against him and mobilized to defeat him 4 years later in 1980.
And you're referring to a court decision that said that charitable organizations couldn't qualify for tax exempt status if they demonstrated racial discrimination.
That's right. And
Bob Jones University wanted to retain its tax exempt status, but at the same time, I guess it didn't allow African Americans to become students there or to teach there.
Bob Jones University did not allow African Americans to be enrolled at the school until 1991, and did not allow unmarried African Americans as students until 1995. The lower court ruling that really became the catalyst for the rise of the religious right was a ruling called Green v. Connolly, issued in 1971 by the District Court of the District of Columbia. And it upheld the Internal Revenue Service in its ruling that any organization that engages in racial segregation or discrimination is not, by definition, a charitable organization, and as such, has no claim to tax-exempt status. And as the IRS began applying that ruling and enforcing it various places, including Bob Jones University, that is what galvanized evangelical leaders into a political movement that we know today as the religious right.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Randall Balmer, author of the new book, God in the White House, How Faith Shaped the Presidency from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush. It's about how religion became politicized and how politics became religionized. When we left off, he was explaining that it wasn't abortion that galvanized the religious right. It was a 1971 lower court ruling affirming the IRS's position that any organization that engages in racial discrimination or segregation is by definition not a charitable organization and therefore has no claim to tax-exempt status. So if abortion wasn't really the issue around which the Christian right initially organized, how did it become that rallying issue?
According to one of the architects of the religious right, who told me this directly, after they had organized on the issue of Bob Jones University and more broadly the issue of government interference in these schools, as they understood it, there was a conference call among these various evangelical leaders and the political consultants who were trying to organize them into a political movement. And several people mentioned several issues. Finally, the voice on the end of one of the lines said, "How about abortion?" And that's how abortion was cobbled into the agenda of the religious right late in the 1970s in preparation for the 1980 presidential election.
After evangelical Christians became disillusioned with President Carter, they rallied around candidate and then President Ronald Reagan. You point out that that seems kind of paradoxical, considering that Reagan was divorced, remarried. He wasn't a churchgoer. We later learned that his wife Nancy consulted an astrologer when analyzing his schedule. So, what do you make of that?
I think it's an odd pairing. It's an odd marriage, if you don't mind my using that expression. Ronald Reagan, of course, was a divorced and remarried man who, by the way, as governor of California in 1967, signed into law the most liberal abortion bill in the country. So he was an odd choice for evangelical activists, especially as we look back on their agenda these days. I remember very clearly growing up as an evangelical in the 1950s and 1960s and even into the 1970s, that divorce was a very real issue. If someone within the congregation was divorced, chances are that she or he would be excluded from the congregation or certainly ostracized by many members of the congregation. This was one of the great taboos within evangelicalism. And what I found, looking through the pages of Christianity Today magazine as just one example of this, is that the denunciations of divorce in the 1970s as compared to the 1980s is dramatic. After 1980, after evangelicals had embraced Ronald Reagan as their political savior, these denunciations drop almost entirely from sight after 1980. And I think that's a rather telling sea change within evangelicalism.
When discussing the meaning of the separation of church and state, President Reagan used an interpretation that is often used by evangelical leaders, which is the First Amendment was written not to protect the people and their laws from religious values, but to protect those values from government tyranny. Was he the first president that you're aware of to use that interpretation of the First Amendment?
I think that's probably would be the first to articulate it in quite that way. But I think the beauty of the First Amendment, as I read American history, is that it has protected both the government and religion from one another. My reading of American religious history is that any time religion gets entangled with the state, with government, it is the faith, it's religion that suffers. I was one of the expert witnesses, for example, in the Alabama Ten Commandments case, arguing against Judge Roy Moore and his placement of the Ten Commandments monument in the judicial building in Montgomery, Alabama. And what I find so striking about that case, well, there are many things, but one of the anecdotes that came out of that case was that as the workers were preparing to remove the monument after Judge Thompson ruled correctly, in my judgment, that the monument violated the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, one of the protesters screamed, "Get your hands off my God." And if I'm not mistaken, one of those commandments etched in the side of that monument says something about a graven image. And that's, I think, the real danger when you conflate church and state. The faith, the integrity of the faith is compromised. It's compromised, for example, when you're trying to introduce prescribed public prayers into public schools. It becomes ritualized and fetishized and trivialized. And I think that's the real danger in these attempts to blur this line of separation between church and state.
Christian conservatives rallied around President Reagan, but how often did he publicly discuss his faith?
Reagan didn't discuss his faith very much. And in fact, as you pointed out, he wasn't a terribly faithful churchgoer. In fact, he wasn't at all. And what I found really striking about the Reagan presidency as I began to do research on this is that Reagan ran for office twice in 1980 and again in 1984, arguing that abortion and the making and the outlawing of abortion was the defining moral issue of our time. And yet even his most fervent supporters now acknowledge that he made very little effort, other than making a speech once or twice in a kind of symbolic way. He exerted very little political effort to outlaw abortion. And in fact, in his autobiography, more than 700 pages, I didn't find the issue once. And I think that's a very telling comment about Reagan and his real commitment to the issue of abortion. I shouldn't say that quite so strongly. I don't know about his real commitment on the issue of abortion, but I think it's it raises questions, at least, why he didn't even address the issue once in his autobiography.
Well, let's move on to our current president, George W. Bush. How do you think he changed the language of personal faith as a presidential candidate and as a president?
I think that Bush's comment on the eve of the Iowa precinct caucuses in response to a question that Jesus was his favorite philosopher utterly astonished most people. Certainly Europeans and the British were just utterly flummoxed by a comment like that. But when a candidate delivers an answer like that, "Jesus is my favorite philosopher," it seems to me that it's fair and appropriate and even mandated that we follow up on an answer like that. "Gee, Governor Bush, your favorite philosopher says that we should turn the other cheek, that his followers should love their enemies. How is that going to affect your foreign policy in the event of, say, a foreign attack on the United States? Or, Governor Bush, your favorite philosopher expressed concern for the tiniest sparrow. Will that sentiment find any resonance in your environmental policies?" I think those are fair questions, and Bush opened himself up to questions like that, to a kind of cross-examination. Unfortunately, no one in the media and none of the voters really followed up on this rather strange declaration on his part.
How do you perceive the evangelical leaders using their political power now compared to when Bush or Reagan was running for office?
I think we're seeing a sea change in evangelical attitudes about voting and political behavior generally. The old line leaders of the religious right, people like Chuck Colson and James Dobson, continue to insist that the only salient moral issues of our time are abortion and same-sex unions. And I think grassroots evangelicals, particularly younger evangelicals, simply don't see it that way. The issue of climate change and global warming is for them a very, very real issue. And I think it's fair to point out, if you're going to push for the teaching of intelligent designs in the public school, then it seems to me you'd want to take some interest in the handiwork of the intelligent designer. And I think a younger generation of evangelicals understands that. They get it. And the older generation simply does not. Other issues, I think, the war in Iraq, this government's use of torture, I think that there's a kind of awakening going on among grassroots evangelicals. They're no longer marching in lockstep to the wishes of people like James Dobson and Pat Robertson and so forth. So I think things are changing in very, very interesting ways in the 2008 presidential race.
Do you hear a change in how Democratic presidential candidates are speaking about religion?
Absolutely. I think the lesson for Democrats from the 2004 presidential election was that they had to learn to speak the language of faith. I think there's a peril for Democrats in doing that if it comes off as being contrived or disingenuous. But so far, what I've heard from the Democratic candidates seems to be quite sincere and from the heart. And as long as they do that, they will be able to at least whittle away at some of this this notion that Democrats are somehow rabid secularists and anti-God or whatever sort of rhetoric is circulating out there.
Mike Huckabee is the only candidate now who identifies as a born-again Christian. What do you hear when you hear him speak about his faith? How does that compare to what you've heard before from candidates?
I think in that sense, Mike Huckabee is very much in the tradition of Jimmy Carter talking about being a born-again evangelical Christian. What worries me about Huckabee is all this language now about revising the Constitution so that it reflects the fact that we are a Christian nation. This sort of argument, this sort of path, I think is very, very dangerous. Religion has flourished in this country. Faith has flourished in this nation precisely because the government has stayed out of the religion business. And once you begin to conflate church and state, once you begin to blur this line of separation between the two, both institutions are compromised. But I'm particularly worried about the compromise of the faith. Faith becomes a fetish. Faith becomes trivialized when it is associated with the state. My reading of American religious history is that religion has always functioned best from the margins of society and not in the councils of power. Because once you begin pandering after political power, you lose your prophetic voice. You lose your prophetic edge. The great genius of 19th century evangelical activism was that it was working from the margins of society and working on behalf of those who were marginalized. And I simply don't see that range of concerns reflected in the actions and the agenda of the religious right at the turn of the 21st century.
Has there ever been a presidential candidate who actually got a foothold who was secular and said, you know, I don't believe in God. I don't practice a religion?
Some people have argued that James Monroe may have been perhaps the only real secular president in American history. But people have also made claims to that effect with Abraham Lincoln, who was not orthodox in any sense that we would recognize today as being religious. And in fact, if Lincoln were running for president today, chances are he would be dismissed, at least by a large section of the voters, as being insufficiently religious, insufficiently pious. So it hasn't happened very much, certainly hasn't happened much lately, where you have a truly secular candidate for president who is successful.
Randall Balmer, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Terry.
Randall Balmer is the author of God in the White House. There's a new book about the band The Fleshtones, and the band has a new CD called Take a Good Look. The Fleshtones started out 3 decades ago in Queens, New York, a bunch of amateur musicians united by a love of 60s garage rock. Most bands that came of age during the punk rock 70s either broke up or faded away, but the Fleshtones persisted. Rock critic Ken Tucker says their new CD is one of their best ever.
Well, come on! Hey, could I be wrong?
If you can resist that sound, you're a stronger soul than I, and I don't want to know you. The Fleshtones' combination of strangled vocals, hand claps, slamming drums, and stabbing organ makes a lot of their music sound like freshly unearthed singles from the 60s and 70s, orgies between the Bo Brummels and Paul Revere and the Raiders. And the sentiments that the band shouts, as well as the harmonica puffed into this next song, evoke a Summer of Love vibe.
People! Listen, gather round and hear what I say. If you think you're getting sad, go get yourself a life. Drive out of that hole right away. Cause there's no greater will than your mental health. Yeah, you better love yourself. Cause if you don't, then no one else will.
The Fleshtones love themselves, but in an ego-free manner. They're committed to making what they only half-jokingly call super rock. It's the spirit of non-stop party music. Among the band's admirers is R.E.M., whose Peter Buck produced their 1993 album Beautiful Light. The Fleshtones' new album, Take a Good Look, was produced by Ivan Julian, once a linchpin of the great, much shorter-lived band Richard Hell and the Voidoids. Julian carves out space in the cluttered din for the lead vocals of Peter Zaremba. There's a new book called Sweat, the story of the Fleshtones' America's Garage Band, in which author Joe Bonomo chronicles the joys and agony of committing yourself to a lifetime of making rock and roll without the status of rock stardom. The Fleshtones come across as wild and dedicated, disciplined and open to any improvisation life throws at them. Of course, they have their regrets. To judge by this song, they wish they'd done the supposedly anti-rock and roll thing and stayed in school. What academia lost in having various Fleshtones in tenured positions around the country, the music world continues to benefit from. As a result, the Fleshtones will come to your town for a night, throw up a wall of amplifiers, shake the ground with their vast catalog of woulda, shoulda, coulda been hits, and then hit the road. Take a good listen to Take a Good Look, and you'll hear the price and pleasure of opting for permanent immaturity.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Take a Good Look by the Fleshtones. Before we get to our review of the new HBO series, In Treatment, I want to let you know that tomorrow our guests will be Mick Jones, the former lead guitarist of The Clash, and Tony James, formerly of Generation X. Their band Carbon Silicon has a new CD. Here's the opening track.
People started caring about what they ate, and people started smiling at everyone they meet, and people started looking for good instead of bad, realized what they could lose and what they always had. People started growing instead of being crushed, and people started slowing down instead of being rushed. People started looking with very different eyes at this information that comes as a surprise. Good morning, here's the news, and all of it is good. Good evening, here's the news, and all of it is good, and the weather's good.
Today, HBO embarks on a risky experiment in primetime programming, a new drama series called In Treatment that's about a psychotherapist and his patients. What's risky isn't so much the subject as how it's being presented. Our TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Therapy sessions on TV are nothing new. They were pricelessly funny on The Bob Newhart Show and endlessly fascinating on The Sopranos. Endlessly fascinating because The Sopranos never ended. And from the true-life confessionals of Dr. Phil to the circus antics of Jerry Springer, people talking about their problems always has proven to be a popular form of television, however repugnant. But In Treatment, premiering tonight on HBO, is something new because of the way it's presented. Based on a hit series from Israel, which pioneered this unusual way of scheduling a primetime series, In Treatment stars Gabriel Byrne as Paul, a therapist treating a handful of patients on a rotating basis. Every Monday, we see Paul with Laura, a patient for a year who suspects she may be in love with him. On Tuesdays, Paul sees Alex, a brand new patient, a bomber pilot recently back from Iraq. On Wednesdays, it's another new patient, Sophie, a teen gymnast and Olympic hopeful, with two broken arms. On Thursdays, it's a session of couples therapy with Jake and Amy, who have plenty of problems. And on Fridays, Paul seeks out guidance from his own therapist, Gina. That weekly schedule is repeated for 9 weeks. That's 45 half-hour shows in all, just about the length of a full season's worth of a one-hour drama series. Logistically, viewers should know that there are lots of ways to catch up, from online to on-demand. But the really important thing to know is that In Treatment is worth the effort. I can see why the concept caught on in Israel, because it's addictive. Each episode and each week adds more components, more conflicts, more surprises. I've seen 7 weeks out of the nine, and I can't wait to see the rest. A large part of the success of In Treatment comes from the actors. Each episode is like a one-act play, very intimate, very demanding. But you never see the actors playing for the cameras or reaching for too much. Gabriel Byrne, who's been a favorite actor of mine ever since Miller's Crossing, is in every episode and never falters. And the rest of the actors are up to the challenge as well. In Treatment is exceptionally well cast. My favorites include Diane Wiest as Paul's therapist, Blair Underwood as the Iraqi war veteran, Josh Charles as the hostile husband in couples therapy, and Melissa George from Alias as Laura, the patient who reveals that she's been fixated on Paul. That's the session that starts off the series, and it sets the hook almost instantly.
How long have you felt like this?
A year. In the first session, I thought it'd go away. I thought it's just an infatuation, that's all. But it's getting worse. You've become the center of my life.
Laura, I'm your therapist. The parameters and the limitations are established and ethically defined. I'm not an option.
Just to show you how complicated things get, let's jump to week 5. Alex, the pilot played by Blair Underwood, has met and dated Laura after meeting her outside Paul's office. Paul's not really comfortable with that. But, as Alex points out, Paul's not comfortable with a lot.
See, that's the real problem with all your theories, Paul. They completely ignore your side of the whole equation, that you are also human. Yeah, you have this nice theory that I see you as my father, and that's why I want to, defy you. But what about you? Why do you keep making it seem as if you have no personal stake in this, as if you're only here for me? It's a deception, Paul. Okay, let's take Laura, for example. You play such a big role in her life, it's unbelievable. She knows nothing about you. She's sure you're one of the most perfect people she's ever met, and she hasn't the faintest idea of who you are, what your beliefs are, how long you've been married, nothing. I mean, doesn't that just seem a little insane to you? Who are you? Really?
This tiny universe of Paul's continues to widen. Eventually, we meet the mother of the young gymnast who attends a session. And, most tellingly of all, we spend more and more time with Paul's wife, Kate. She's played by the remarkable Michelle Forbes from Homicide: Life on the Street, and, more recently, from Battlestar Galactica. When we get our first glimpses of Kate, she seems fairly hostile and aloof. Before long, we discover why. In Treatment is one long exercise in discovery. It explores therapy while humanizing therapists. And it's a series of character studies as concentrated as compelling as you'll find anywhere on television. I'm so into this show, I'm not thinking primarily about the caliber of the performances. I'm worried about what will happen to the characters. That's a sign, I think, of a really good TV series. Then again, it may be a sign that I need some professional help. And I know just the therapist I'd like to consult.
David Bianculli writes about television for TVWorthWatching.com.